Good morning, everybody. My name's Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here. Today we're going to be looking at the life and work and the legacy of Howard Thurman, who we were just hearing about there on that brief video. We're in a series at the moment where we're looking at ways we can have a deeper experience of God through things like fasting, simplicity, letting go, and those practices associated with that form of spirituality. And we're in a point in the series where we've transitioned a little bit to talking about different figures in history who have developed practices that certainly work for them and perhaps can work for us, ways we can learn from some of these figures. And we've been looking, for instance, at Brother Lawrence. A couple of weeks ago, last week, we looked at Saint Thérèse of Lisieux. And today, we're going to look at Howard Thurman. We'll have someone else next week. I think one of the things we've noted when we've looked at these characters and as we've thought about this contemplative spirituality that we're talking about, that there's this very, there's a very practical nature to it. So even though Brother Lawrence was in a monastery, as was Saint Thérèse, their spirituality was all about practical living. How do you experience God in the humdrum of daily life? How do you live out your spirituality very really and very practically? Today, we're going to really take a look at that because Howard Thurman brought together in this really energetic way the contemplative, the inward life of our spirituality with the outward, the activistic. And it's no coincidence that the civil rights movement and Howard Thurman was a huge influence in the formative years of the civil rights movement, as we saw there. It's no coincidence that this radical theology that he developed of nonviolence comes out of a very deep place. It doesn't just happen. It's not just like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Let's practice nonviolence. When you're in the midst of violence and violence is being perpetrated against you, probably the last thing on your mind is nonviolence. You want to protect yourself. You want to defend yourself. But Thurman was a contemplative that looked deeply at the issues. And as we heard in that little video, he was a mystic. So he was able to reflect on the inward life and this sort of chaos and disorder that we often experience inwardly when we're under pressure, even just in everyday life personally, but certainly in situations that the people of color experience every day in our culture and historically, as we saw in some of that footage there. How can we respond from a more ordered, less chaotic, more simplified, more whole inward life in order that something more healthy might come out that brings not only transformation for ourselves, but transformation for the world. So we're going to explore some of that today. A couple of books. One was referenced there. We'll read a little bit from Jesus and the Disinherited. This is a very short book, but just a profound book. Some of you may have read this already. We'll read a few excerpts from this. He also wrote another book called Meditations of the Heart, many other writings. And you'll see in the material for this week, there are different excerpts and quotes from Howard Thurman that you might want to look at and discuss and reflect upon as well. And there's also an exercise in the material. So grab a copy of the material from the welcome desk outside, or you can download it online. I do encourage you to take a look at that. So before we go any further, I'm going to invite up a good friend of mine, Hubert. Actually, why don't you come on up? Hubert is going to come and join us. Let's give him a round of applause. So we're gonna kind of do this together. Hubert's on the board. He's a high school leader as well. Does lots of different things around it. But Hubert, you're a fan of Howard Thurman, right?
Yes.
I've got one or two notes here just to keep us on track because both you and me could get right.
We could go off track and not end up talking about the subject.
Right. How did you first run into Howard Thurman? What was your sort of first experience of that? How did that happen?
Which is interesting, and actually it was yesterday that I confirmed this, because when we were meeting, talking about this whole series, when it came up that Howard Thurman and his thoughts and his work on the theology of nonviolence, it was like, oh, wow, okay. And I realized I've kind of felt like I've always known Thurman or known of Thurman and his influence, but I couldn't remember exactly where that came from. At first I thought, well, maybe it was something with my parents, and it's like, No, because my parents didn't actually believe in nonviolence, so I know that I didn't talk to them about this. And then I had the opportunity through work years ago at the Highlander Center to meet a lot of folks who were involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And I thought, and I know that Thurman came up in conversations, but I realized, no, I knew about Thurman to be able to have those conversations. And then it occurred to me, it's like, ah, my grandmama Dixon. When I was a kid growing up in Nashville, Tennessee, my grandparents had a subscription to Ebony magazine, and they would always leave it out for anyone to
just got
read.
A different mic for you.
Oh,
here, so.
Okay.
Let's see if this works a little better.
Okay.
I think there was a little bit of background noise.
Is that a little better? And it occurred to me, it's like, it was probably there. And then I went on my little computer phone that we all have and saw it was 1978, February of 1978, there was an article about Thurman. And I would have been at their house at that time. And I'm sure that's where I first came across who Thurman was, about his writings, and beginning the journey of understanding the influence that he's had, not only throughout the world, but particularly for African American pastors.
Yeah. And would you say that he was somebody who was perhaps more behind the scenes in terms of, you know, he's not so well known mm-hmm. as many of the other civil rights leaders, but hugely influential, as we saw there from that.
Oh, absolutely. And in so many different interesting layers. Beyond what was shown there, he's originally from Daytona, Florida, and grew up in a segregated community there, was a top student, but lived in a community that, for African Americans, public education only went up to seventh grade. His principal taught him for the entire year of what would have been his eighth grade that allowed him to go to a high school in another city, since there were no high schools for African Americans in Daytona. And then he goes to college in Morehouse in Atlanta and befriends a person named Martin Luther King Sr. And they had a lifelong relationship with each other. And years later, when he's working at Howard University as a dean, he takes a delegation of folks to India and Sri Lanka on a 6-month tour, speaking and talking and meeting with folks, and he is the first African American pastor to meet Mahatma Gandhi and have the conversation about the nonviolent struggle that's taken place in India in the 1930s, and really is the touch point for two or three generations of African American leaders becoming aware on a very personal level of the influence of nonviolent social change, and that it's not just pacifism, but it's much more, in some ways I would argue, complicated than that.
Yeah, it's not just the absence of violence, it's much more active and intentional than that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, and in the book, so there's a beautiful, I really recommend it. So Jesus and the Disinherited, it's a short book, but it's one of those ones where you stop every 5 seconds to it, because it's so deep. And there's a beautiful, I mean, it's tragic, but there's a beautiful story about his time in India there fairly early on in the chapter, where he's kind of faced with a Hindu criticism of Christianity because of some of the oppressive tendencies it's had throughout history. Something that strikes me as I read it is it was written in 1949, right? He first published it in 1949, but so much of it feels very familiar. I mean, it's, and even turns of phrase that we use all the time now. But he was speaking into a very risky situation when he started talking about nonviolence, right? Tell us a little bit about that. I know you just mentioned, for instance, that your own family were not advocates of nonviolence, right? How did that impact the African American community when he was talking like that?
I think it's one of those things where today we very casually use the phrase nonviolence in terms of you know, any kind of social action that folks are involved in today, or a belief that, oh, everyone was on board with the teachings of King and Thurman and others in terms of nonviolence, but that's really not historically correct. And I can, again, speaking from my own experience, my parents were more, they're a little more Old Testament when it came to the idea of violence. You know, they distinctly, I grew up, it was the first generation that went through desegregated schools in Nashville, Tennessee. And my parents were very clear. It's like, you know, they weren't, if someone hits you, don't give them the other cheek. It's you give them a left or right hook. And so it, There, and distinctly, I remember having conversations about like not really believing in this idea of nonviolence. It's like you need to defend yourself, and so I think there was a lot more of that. And then if you really look at American history broadly, not just African American, but American, the history of the United States, it's just pretty much, it's very violent. You know, the concept of nonviolence is incredibly countercultural and even counterintuitive, that some would argue.
Well, so what do you mean by that, that American culture or history is violent?
I mean, the nation was started through in the crucible of a revolution with war with Great Britain. Its biggest test on which direction that it was going to go as a nation or a separation of states was the American Civil War, were also a time of violent, an incredible time of violence. And I would say today, even the identity of the United States in an international as a force for good comes more because of our actions during World War II as a nation than through any of our, more so than the humanitarian efforts. So, and not to mention, you know, for folks who are fans of Alexander Hamilton, we have folks who've engaged in duels, and he wasn't the only one at the time. So there's a lot of violence that's baked into American history.
I mean, in some sense, what you're saying is culturally, the way to resolve problems is through war or through violence. Mm-hmm. That's been the precedent, and this was novel. This was somewhat outrageous.
Yes,
I mean radical would be probably, you know, is an overused word, but it probably applies here.
But the idea of particularly the young people who are involved in the nonviolent activities of the 50s and 60s, in particular, that were not only had to go through the personal thought and self-reflection to be able to do this, and the training to be able to deal with the fact that you're going to be met with violence, and the way to morally overcome this condition is through nonviolence, is, you know, it's very radical.
And I think we're going to look at, we've got a few points here to look. Maybe we can put that slide up, Sarah. So these are just some observations about the civil rights movement and their leaders. So, and so in some respects, given that the influence of Howard Thurman, these are observations really in many respects about Howard Thurman as well. I mean, we could overlay those. And we're just going to talk about each one for a little bit. Deep insight about the nature of the real problem. And remember, what we're talking here is about someone who is bringing together activism and the contemplative life. So this is coming from a depth of reflection and contemplation about all sorts of things, the nature of the real problem. And I think what we see here is Thurman not saying, don't be angry, right? So this is not about, everybody just calm down in the face of violence, everybody calm down in the face of oppression, just sort of put up with it. But rather, looking at what is the real nature of the problem? And is the problem we just need to get revenge, or we need to fight back, we need to take over, or is the problem really there's disunity amongst humanity? And the goal, in other words, is not just revenge, but the goal is unity, the goal is healing, the goal is reconciliation. I mean, to it takes incredible courage, I think, to pursue that. And then we'll talk in a moment about, and then it begs the question, well, am I contributing to that? How is my action going to contribute to healing, as opposed to just be my own personal my own ego being satisfied that I've had some comeuppance or whatever it is. Now, Jesus gets into this, obviously, in a very controversial way. I think we can put that scripture up from Matthew 5 in a section of the Sermon on the Mount, which, by the way, we're going to be focusing on the Sermon on the Mount during the season of Lent, which begins soon. So we'll come back to these kinds of issues. But we've heard this before, right? So it sort of just rolls off the tongue. You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, which is kind of, I guess that's the norm, right? That's the Old Testament, if you like, if you want to put it that way, or it's the precedent of that's how things generally get resolved. But I tell you, this is Jesus, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. So in the book, he really gets into this issue of placing Jesus in a very real oppressive system in first century Palestine. So he says, you know, his view of Jesus is, okay, Jesus was around between the annexation of Palestine into Syria by the Romans and the fall of the temple it's an annexation, I think it was AD 60, AD 70, the fall of the temple. So Jesus is in Palestine at a time when there's all kinds of oppression going on, there's all kinds of political turmoil. So Jesus is not talking in some sort of religious higher plane that's not rooted in the practicalities of everyday life, and the practicalities of everyday life being, how do we survive in this oppressive system, and how do we speak to this oppressive system without just creating more oppression, without just creating more violence? So it's incredibly practical. Now, the second point up here, I think, sort of follows on from that, if we go back. So there's a fearlessness in looking into the darkness. And I think this is a part of the contemplative approach, that there's a looking at the darkness in the world and not running from it, not withdrawing from it, having hope that actually I can go to it with hope rather than fear, and go to it with love rather than fear. But also looking on the inside of, okay, how is this making me respond? What's coming out from me? And looking at that darkness and the reality of hatred and the reality of retribution, and really addressing that and dealing with that. And as I was saying earlier, it's like almost like dealing with the chaos of that. And I think we can all relate to that, because we are in multiple situations probably every day where there's conflict, or there's, you know, we feel unjustly treated, or something happens and we get super stirred up within. And then we know that when we're super stirred up like that, we're not necessarily responding with our best. We're not necessarily responding to the situation in the most healthy of ways. Again, doesn't mean don't be angry. It's just, how can we be angry in an energetic, focused, healthy way when anger is required? I'm going to just read a little bit here from, just this is the very beginning of Jesus and the Disinherited. So listen to the words of Thurman here. It's a couple of pages, so, you know, just soak it in. He begins this way: many and varied are the interpretations dealing with the teachings and the life of Jesus of Nazareth, but few of these interpretations deal with what the teachings and the life of Jesus have to say to those who stand at a moment in human history with their backs against the wall. To those who need profound succor and strength to enable them to live in the present with dignity and creativity, Christianity often has been sterile and of little avail. The conventional Christian word is muffled, confused, and vague. Too often the price exacted by society for security and respectability is that the Christian movement, in its formal expression, must be on the side of the strong against the weak. This is a matter of tremendous significance, for it reveals to what extent a religion that was born of a people acquainted with persecution and suffering has become the cornerstone of a civilization and of nations whose very position in modern life has too often been secured by a ruthless power applied to weak and defenseless peoples. Okay, so Thurman is coming from the perspective of a Jesus follower, right? He's rooted in the Christian history. He clearly loves Jesus. He clearly is a follower. But he's able to look at the darkness, even within his own faith tradition, and not just try to sort of tweak it a bit, but actually see what's really going on here. He goes on to say this: it is not a singular thing to hear a sermon that defines what should be the attitude of the Christian towards people who are less fortunate than himself. Again and again, our missionary appeal is on the basis of the Christian responsibility to the needy, the ignorant, and the so-called backward peoples of the earth. There is a certain grandeur and nobility in administering to another's needs out of one's fullness and plenty. One could be selfish using his possessions, material or spiritual, for strictly private or personal ends. It is certainly to the glory of Christianity that it has been most insistent on the point of responsibility to others whose only claim upon one is the height and depth of their need. This impulse at the heart of Christianity is the human will to share with others what one has found meaningful to oneself, elevated to the height of a moral imperative. I think we'd probably all agree with that. But there is a lurking danger in this very emphasis. It is exceedingly difficult to hold oneself free from a certain contempt for those whose predicament makes moral appeal for defense and succor. It is the sin of pride and arrogance that has tended to vitiate the missionary impulse and to make of it an instrument of self-righteousness on the one hand and racial superiority on the other. So what Thermas is doing here, I think you see, is taking a deep look, a deep, slow look. It's a deep, slow reflection on the nature of the problem. And there's something about this, I guess, that is pretty shocking, right? I mean, that would, you know, tell us how you react to that.
I mean, if you're looking at the times in which this was written in, so this is late 1940s, there is within the United States a general, I mean, there's the two Americas that are existing at this point. One that's that's white America, that we've won World War II, we're supporting the nations of the world, we're good people. Mm-hmm. And there is, in terms of what we would call people of color, but explicitly, I think, from a Black American experience for myself, it's like, wait a minute, we fought this war for justice and peace and for democracy, yet it still doesn't exist in this country. Mm-hmm. It's still a segregated land. The soldiers can come back from serving overseas and still can't get access to education or a home loan or all the other things that are supposed to be part of this great victory that's taken place. And so to me, what I hear is Thurman like looking at, let's not look at the supposed identification in a sense with Rome, but let's look at those oppressed people who are who have as much right to be loved and are loved by the God of the universe, mm-hmm. than what is being presented kind of a popular view.
So really, I mean, I think of that again on a personal level, that we, because you're talking there really in its sense systemically, which is mm-hmm. really important. Mm-hmm. But I think also we can relate to it on a personal level, that we all want to be the good person, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. So when any argument or any conflict or any disagreement, mm-hmm. we're always trying to take the higher ground, because mm-hmm. we want to believe that actually it's not us. It's mm-hmm. I think this is where, again, the practices of reflection and silence and solitude and many of the things that we've been talking about recently come into where we can be honest in an atmosphere of love, be really honest about ourselves, mm-hmm. and change is possible from that point, where we can actually make a positive contribution mm-hmm. rather than the next one. But you have to start with the honesty, mm-hmm. right? You've got to get that. Let's just look at another point here. We'll go. So another observation: incredible self-awareness and self-discipline. So this sort of comes back to the issue of non-violence, of saying, okay, Thurman was not just looking at the nature of the problem, but also looking at what is the solution to this? Because there's many possible solutions. And he talks in the book about, he goes through the solutions, like, well, okay, so one response could be violence, Violence could be a legitimate response, and obviously, you know, people have pursued that. One response could be actually non-resistance to saying, either out of fear or apathy, or this is just not going, nothing's going to work here, so to withdraw from that. I'm just going to read another quote from him here, because I think he realized this is not going to go down well with everybody, and he very much identified with Jesus in that way, as someone who ultimately was rejected in many respects. So this is Thurman really talking about the way of Jesus in the Roman context of pursuing love and nonviolence as a solution. It was but natural that such a position would be deeply resented by many of his followers who were suffering even as he was. To them, it was a complete betrayal to the enemy. It was to them a counsel of acquiescence, if not of despair, full to overflowing with a kind of groveling and stark cowardice. Besides, it seemed like self-deception, like whistling in the dark. All of this would have been quite true if Jesus had stopped there. He did not. He recognized with authentic realism that anyone who permits another to determine the quality of his inner life gives into the hands of the other the keys to his destiny. If a man knows precisely what he can do to you or what epithet he can hurl against you in order to make you lose your temper, your equilibrium, then he can always keep you under subjection. It is a man's reaction to things that determines their ability to exercise power over him. Just so here, we're talking, this is an old text, so there's not particularly gender-inclusive language being used here, but we're going to let him off the hook for that one. It seems clear that Jesus understood the anatomy of the relationship between his people and the Romans, and he interpreted that relationship against the background of the profoundest ethical insight of his own religious faith, as he found it in the heart of the prophets of Israel. I could carry on reading here, because this is just really beautiful stuff, but I'm going to hold back there. So this issue of non-violence comes from, you know, we made that point there about an unbelievable place of self-discipline and self-control, of looking at yourself and realizing that my natural tendency, my natural response, both because I want to overcome my enemy and because I don't want to look foolish to my peers, my colleagues, my comrades, right? Because they're, you know, my way might sound like it's crazy. Both of those could be emotional responses that would cause us not to take the right action. So this capacity not to be thrown off by your enemy or your friend even is just incredible. You see that, I feel like you see that reflected in the life of MLK, for instance, like the temptation to give up, the temptation to just react out of another center must have been huge. I mean, just speak to that a little
bit. Yeah, I think there's a lot of writings from the folks who were closest around King about like moments of self-doubt that he had about what was going on, but and going on with himself. But I think it's also, it's that real statement of, to me, about your own empowerment. And I think this connects to some of our themes over these past few weeks, is that you actually do have some say in how you react to the world. It takes some reflection. It may take small steps actually to get to that point. And it takes some time and reflection. But we have been given by God this ability to be empowered, that we don't have to let those who would disempower us or systems that would disempower, we have, because we know the love of Jesus, or if we can know that, overcome all of that.
Yeah. But and obviously I'm not, you know, I'm thinking more about myself, but it's great to talk about nonviolence and the safety of a room like this. But when you're facing the water cannons or the clubs or the horses, you don't know it's going to work, right? I mean, so the courage there has to come from a really deep place, right?
And the faith, right?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately it's because you don't know.
Yeah,
you don't know what the outcome is going to be,
yeah.
And so it's I think one of the truest expressions of faith those folks during those times exhibited. And I think there's a rootedness that goes back beyond even this period of faith of and belief and hope that things will get better.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. So this is rooted very deeply. Let's just look at a couple of scriptures here, because again, this is all Jesus. Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen and understand." Is there a bit more than that? Maybe I get that. So we'll come on to this bit. Sorry, I may have given the wrong text there. Sorry about that. Jesus' disciples are accused of not being very religious because they don't wash their hands before meals. That was the sort of standard religious practice. And so, he's challenged about his disciples and their practices. And so Jesus goes on to say this: "Don't you see that whatever enters your mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body? But the things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart, and these defile them." So they're worried that, okay, if you don't wash your hands, bad stuff's going to go in your mouth when you eat it. And Jesus is saying, that's not the issue here. That's when it comes down to real spirituality, the issue is not what's going physically into your mouth. It's what's coming out of your mouth, because that's, I think he's referring there to life and words and the ways we interact with people, because that comes from the heart. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander. A good old list there. These are what defile a person, but eating with unwashed hands does not defile them. I think what Jesus is getting at there is that what happens on the outside is really coming from the inside, right? So when you think about the power of the civil rights movement in terms of nonviolence, what it took to do that, it's no wonder it took someone like Thurman, from a contemplative mystical point of view, reflecting on the inner life of human beings and what it's the courage, the strength, the faith, the honesty that it's going to take to have that kind of outward strength. And that's so consistent with what Jesus is talking about. We'll just look at one more point here on that list we had, because we're going to transition a bit in a second. But faithful in small things over the long haul. So the civil rights movement has kept going. I mean, it hasn't given up. I love the fact that in a conversation we had once, Hubert, we were talking about, oh yeah, he mentored Martin Luther King Jr. So that's a big thing that he did, right? But he also had, even locally, because he was at Howard University, had lots of small influences on people who have had lots of smaller influences on people. We were talking about small things last week, but I mean, you've kind of you're conscious of that even in this area that we live in, right?
Yeah, I think that we sometimes, so often, particularly when it's Black History Month and they have those little commercials and everything, it's like the compression of trying to describe the civil rights movement is like from 1955 to 1965, these things happen, when it is a long haul. Mm-hmm. And that it's not just the Birmingham and the March on Washington and Memphis, but it's the hundreds of communities across the country and here locally explicitly as well, where struggles took place, where folks transformed what the cultural norm was, both not only in the law, but in how people dealt with each other day to day. The struggle still continues in many different ways on a daily basis, but it's Thurman's work and others that helped lay nurture the garden of being able to do that. And I think that can't be it really can't be understated. And it impacts on how we move forward even today.
Yeah, let's just shift a little bit, because we're going to sort of talk more and practice actually something which is more about application. Okay, so I think we scratched the surface, if anything, of the life of Thurman. Again, would really recommend particularly this book, Jesus and the Disinherited. I know for me, I was mentioning this earlier, I know for me that there's many situations in which I get stirred up, right? Conflict, difficult situations, or treated what you think is unfairly, and my emotions can get up. I think that I don't think I'm the only person in the room who would say yes to that. I think in our family situations, that's very often the case, right? We're a little bit more unguarded in our family situations, and sometimes we can just react. Maybe we're not even aware that we're stirred up, and we're just letting it out, and people are having to take it. Maybe we are aware of it, but we don't really know how to control it. And I can think of multiple situations where in my relationship with my wife, with the kids, where I've kind of just reacted, I know, out of a bad place, and it's just not helped at all. It doesn't actually accomplish anything. It really, so whether it's emotional violence or whether it's inappropriate anger, whatever it is, or even withdrawal, right? Because sometimes that's the way we react to a situation. We just withdraw, we shut down. Those non-healthy responses just don't really help. A couple of days ago, I was in a conversation with somebody in my family, nobody in this room, just so you know, and they were kind of being a little inappropriate, and I could feel myself getting stirred up, and I wanted to just kind of let them have it. And I realized that's going to make things worse. So in a split second, that's really going to make things worse. And I was able to actually haul myself in a bit and just sort of center a bit more and then come out with, I think, what was a better response that didn't solve the problem. And it didn't necessarily make me look any better, but I think it was the right thing to do. And even just over the last few days, I think it's borne some fruit. So it is possible. And if I can do that, then there's hope for all of us, right? So at a personal level, I think we get how these things apply. But at a systemic level also, I find myself, so I'm a white male, when I think about, intellectually, I think about the fact that however many millennia, there's been male domination in human culture, right? Just about every culture we talk about. And so I'm part of that, I'm the beneficiary of that, I don't think of myself as being a sexist. I don't think of myself as being a racist, but as a white person, I'm in a privileged position in a system of over 400 years of racism, right? So I get that intellectually, right? I understand that. I would, if I was putting out a questionnaire or someone was interviewing me, I'd say, I get sexism, I get racism. But the last thing I want to do is be thought of as a racist or as a sexist. So when I'm in conversations with people who are maybe feeling angry, or people who are responding from a way because they feel they're subject to sexism or to racism, I'm quick to defend myself. I don't want to be branded that way. I don't want to be known as somebody who's sexist or racist. And so, and my ego kicks in, and I'm more trying to defend myself, more feeling worried about my own level of discomfort than I am about what is the right response here. How do I understand more deeply? How do I respond with something more positive to the situation? So it impacts us there, I think, around some of these issues we've been talking about that Thurman brings up. What is the right internal response so that I could bring something positive and healthy to the situation we're in? And I think we observe in our culture right now, in terms of political discourse, that is not going very well, right? That whole thing, let's just say, is not going terribly well. So there's something, I think, the way of Jesus, to me, offers some hope. And let's face it, Thurman is hot on the heels of Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to follow Jesus. It offers some hope for another way. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, though, Hubert, like, what for you, so as an African-American in the culture now, what's the challenge for you, do you think, emotionally? Like, where do you find you might have some struggle emotionally to center yourself and bring a healthy response? I mean, that's I'm sure that's not easy.
Yeah, and be 100% clear, I'm not speaking on behalf of all African Americans, people of color, or anything like that. Just responding for myself. I mean, there's layers of things, because I'm not just one of anything, and for challenges that I deal with as an African American male, as an older African American male, are different from when I was younger, and also the I don't know if it's balance, but the imbalance of the sexism that I have, that I continue to struggle with, and thankfully have had women in my life who've been able to call me on my stuff, and I didn't like it, and then realized they were right. So I think it's complicated, like anything else. But I think what comes back to me in terms of when I think about Thurman and my parents and grandparents and the teachings of Jesus, it's like so important it is to just sometimes just to be quiet and to just to listen to what folks are saying. And that as much as, and I'm always still guilty of this, wanting to react to listen and hear what folks are saying, and then trying to engage people in conversation more than anything else, which is, but again, I just don't want to sound like a hypocrite. It's like sometimes it is, I don't always do that. But I think trying to have a thoughtful conversation with folks and just to hear folks. I think one of the things that the blessing of working over at the barn with the high school students is when we do highs and lows or when we do small group moments of just hearing what the young folks are saying and not just always like, well, what I want to tell you when I was your age, and being that kind of overly preachy about things and just hearing how some things are similar and some things are different in terms of the struggles that folks are doing, and that everyone has some struggle that they're dealing with, whether some people are more open with that or not than others, but what's the point that we have, and that in the end of the day that we have more, I think, in common than we have in differences. The differences are opportunities to build bridges with each other, and those common points may not be in ways that folks always anticipate. Because if we're always just thinking about what we look like or what we're out on the outside, we miss those inside moments. And the fact that we're more than just flesh and blood, that we're, to quote Yoda, luminous beings that shine, and that, you know, and when we have those moments where we come together, we share a meal, we share laughter, that we have greater potential beyond what the broader culture may be telling us that we should engage in name calling and see how we're separate and be told that we're so separate from each other when we really have a lot to learn from each other, and that the God of the universe wants more of us than separation and conflict, but for us to love one another.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Hubert. Let's give a round of applause. Thanks, buddy. I'll do the prayer now. So we're going to, in a minute, we're going to a time of communion, right? So we'll have communion, and we do this pretty much the same way every week. There'll be this table here and the two tables at the side. You can come forward and serve one another or be served by the servers at the side. You can make a financial offering during that time. The band will be playing. We'll be singing a couple of songs together to wrap up. You can write out a prayer under grow and journey and heart cry that you just want to, you don't want to necessarily talk to somebody about that right now, but just want to write it out. We'll pray for you during the week. But if you want to talk to somebody or have somebody pray with you, you can meet us at the back of the room where we'll be available to pray. You can light a candle or just sit quietly, whatever is appropriate for you. But to lead us into communion, we're going to practice together the welcoming prayer, what's known as the welcoming prayer. And this is a prayer, it's the practice for this week and the material that I mentioned. So you get a chance to do this every day if you want. And I'd encourage you to get, if you haven't got the material, get a copy and do this exercise. Maybe we can put the next slide up, Sarah. So the welcoming prayer is based on the fact that we all have these emotional needs, right? We all have deep human needs that are not bad. They're good things, right? We all have a need and a desire for esteem and affection, right? We want to be loved. We want to be loved and accepted. That's a good, healthy thing. For safety and security, those are good things, right? It's not good to want to be insecure or to be in danger. For power and control, those tend to get sort of have a sort of, you know, a negative connotation. But, you know, we all need a certain amount of power and a certain amount of control over our lives. That's a normal, healthy need and desire. The trouble is, we don't always get these. And we're in situations where those, any one of those or all of them are under threat. And it's usually one of these which causes us to get stirred up and get afraid to react in a negatively emotional way, right? Nothing wrong with emotions, but negative emotions or emotion that causes us to take unhealthy action, that's what the problem is. So the prayer that we do for the welcoming prayer really just tries to get us centered on where the fear or where the pain is coming from, right? And it's traced back to one of those things. So what we do is we just first of all notice our emotion, right? And as I mentioned earlier, some of us, this might be the very first step. We're just reacting throughout the day in all kinds of situations, and we're not aware that actually we're reacting out of something internal that we haven't really become aware of or identified yet. So when we're having a negative emotion, a feeling of maybe fear or anger or hatred or guilt or shame or whatever it is, we just want to be aware of it, notice it, and welcome it, right? And this is the not fearing the darkness, as we were talking about with Howard Thurman, but looking it square in the eye, and instead of running from it and withdrawing from it and stuffing it down, we're just going to pursue that emotion. We're going to welcome that emotion. And that might feel very uncomfortable because we're so used to denying our emotions or we're so used to stuffing them down. So we notice, we welcome, and then we connect it to the root. You know, in what way is this coming from? A lack of esteem and affection? Is it? Am I feeling like I'm just not loved in this situation or not accepted in this situation? That's stirring me up. Is it because I don't feel safe? Whatever it is. And again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't want to feel those things. We're just acknowledging that in this situation, in this conflict, if you like, let's say a conflict situation, I'm just not feeling loved. I'm not feeling accepted. And the thing is, I don't get to control that though. So the sort of the secret here is the fourth stage here, or the final stage, which is letting go, saying, okay, I'm just going to relinquish my demand for acceptance in this situation. I don't seem to be getting it. I'm just going to let it go. Now, what this is not about is saying our emotions don't matter. It's not about saying, you know, don't get angry about things. It's actually empowering, because what it can do is as we let go of things, we're able to actually respond out of a place of health, where it's not our own ego, it's not our own needs now that are at the fore, but the right response, a healthy response, a measured response, a powerful response, a focused response. This is what it empowers us to do. So we're just going to close our eyes for a moment. We're going to pray this prayer just for a few moments. If you want to close your eyes, I think that helps. And we'll just go through these phases. So you might feel something right now, or you know, it might be very easy for you to get in touch with an emotional negative feeling right now. It might be to do with a relationship issue or situation at work, a situation in the family. It could be anything, but just connect with something that is making you feel pretty upset at the moment. Something that you're feeling stirred up about, that's kind of doesn't feel good. Just connect with that. Just become aware. And sometimes we feel those things in our body, and you might feel it in your guts, you might feel it in your chest or in your head. And if you want to, just put your hand on that part of your body where you're feeling that tension, you're feeling that emotion. So just be aware of it. And now, welcome it. Once you've identified it, once you've become aware of it, just welcome it. It may feel painful, but don't withdraw from it. Just welcome. Say welcome fear, welcome anxiety, welcome guilt. And you're welcoming it because it's going to show you something about yourself. It's going to connect you to something much deeper here. for all these phases of the prayer, you might need to take a little bit longer on any one phase. Maybe it's the awareness, maybe it's the welcoming. So I'd encourage you to practice this after today as well. But right now, in this moment, just now, try and connect that emotion to one of those things we talked about. Is it a lack of esteem and affection? Why are you feeling this way? Why do you feel this emotion? Is it lack of love? Lack of safety or security? Lack of power or control? Try and connect it to one of those. And when you feel you maybe have identified something there, let's let go. This has got to be the hardest part. How do you let go? And there's the conundrum of the way to let go is to let go. So just even practicing a tiny bit of let go means that perhaps next time we can let go a little bit more. So it's a practice. So just let go of the demand for esteem and affection, or the demand for safety and security, or the demand for power and control in this situation. Just let it go. Relinquish it. And then in that space, invite God's presence, God's love, God's acceptance, the security of God's love, the power of God's love. Let that pour into the space. And then just stay there. And whenever you're ready, the band are going to start some music, but whenever you're ready, you can come forward and have communion, or you may just want to sit for a little bit more, and that's fine too. Do what's ever appropriate for wherever you feel you're at right now. But we'll begin the communion time.